is the clearest window to the human soul. As Cézanne once said, we live in a rainbow of chaos. And the desperate solitude of Van Gogh, with his mysterious and innate ability to thrive in the sorrowful conflicts that comprise his burdensome life. He committed suicide. A woman on the fringes of the conversation ventured, "Hogwash! He was murdered, likely by a teenager wearing a Buffalo Bill outfit, of all things." The crowd grew silent at that one, but the woman persisted. "Surely you're joking. He, a young man whose family summered south of Paris. I don't recall the name. René Secretan." He studied me, somewhat put off. "That's right. The pharmacist's son had seen the Wild West show the year before Van Gogh's death, and they say he modeled himself after Bill Cody, wearing a buckskin outfit with fringe, a cowboy hat, and an actual pistol that worked sometimes. Evidently it worked the morning he shot the Dutch painter." Scratching his head, which did nothing to straighten his hair, he pointed toward me with the cigarette. "You seem sure."
"So do you."
"I'm sure of the theory, but you seem absolute in it." He studied me, unhappy that I'd taken some of his spotlight. "Are you some kind of art historian or something?"
No.
Baron took my elbow and spoke. "Count, this is Walt Longmire, the sheriff, from over in Absaroka County." He sniffed in disapproval. "A sheriff? When I'm not on the lecture circuit." There was a twitter of perfunctory laughter, but not from him. "And on what do you base your absolutist theory?" "Forensic evidence, of which there was a recent review, that said there were no traces of powder burn, even on the hands, in a period when handgun cartridges were loaded with black powder, smokeless powder having only been introduced in 1884. Black powder is extremely dirty and only burns about half its mass when fired, so there would have been a great deal of it evident if the artist had shot himself." The Count rested an elbow on a crossed arm, holding the cigarette from his mouth. "Really?" "Also, the gun had been fired, most likely from a range of 2 feet, and at an oblique angle from the left." Another man looked doubtful. "What does that—" "Van Gogh was right-handed." I sipped my beer. "If it was suicide, as he himself claimed, why shoot yourself in the stomach with your offhand and then limp home and curl up in your bed to take 29 hours to die? Why was the pistol never found, and why did his paint, easel, canvases, and other supplies never turn up?" The Count adjusted his glasses. "Then why do you suppose he told the gendarme when asked if he'd intended to commit suicide that he thought he had?" "He was covering for the young man who had shot him. Secretan was a brat who had publicly tormented Van Gogh and only later in life admitted to loaning Vincent the gun, which, if he did, could be seen as a criminal act in itself considering the man's mental state. I think Vincent didn't want the boy to suffer and took the shooting as an opportunity to end a painful and tortured life." "Death by Buffalo Bill," the Count silently mimicked, clapping. "Bravo, bravo." I affected a slight bow and then watched as he took an extra moment to stare at me. Then he strolled off, pushing open a glass door and walking into the garden, where he dropped his head and cupped his hands, attempting to light a cigarette. A chic brunette with just a trace of silver in her hair touched my arm, and I turned, happy to see Donna Johnson, a friend and ex-CIA analyst. "So whatever happened to Secretan?" "He became a well-respected banker and businessman in France." Her husband, Wally, laughed and slapped me on the shoulder. "Sounds like they needed Walt Longmire." I shrugged and glanced outside, where the Count had disappeared. I smiled an apology. "Excuse me." Moving through the crowd, I opened the door, relieved to be outside, especially in the garden. I just started to adjust my eyes and look around when a tall young man, impeccably dressed and with formidable blonde hair, appeared to my right. "Can I help you?" "I was looking for Count von Lehmann." "And this is concerning?" I stared at him for a moment. "Who exactly are you?" He stuck out a hand. "Conrad Weston. I'm the Count's personal attaché." We shook. "Walt Longmire, Absaroka County Sheriff." There was a strange noise as if crickets were chirping, and he held up a long finger. "Excuse me for just a moment." He produced a small cell phone from an inside pocket and stepped away, speaking into it. "Yes?" He turned, and I couldn't make out the conversation, but after a moment he turned back, pocketing the device. So, is there a problem?
Not if I can talk to the Count.
He smiled a perfunctory grin. Well, perhaps if you tell me what this is pertaining to? A voice called out from the darkness. Who sold you that jacket? Nodding to the young man, I wedged off the jacket, laid it over my arm, and moved toward a fountain to my right, where the voice had come from. Spotting the glow of his cigarette, I changed direction toward the bench where he sat. It's a rental. It's a rental for someone two sizes smaller than you. It was spur of the moment, and they did the best with what they had in stock. I'm glad you took it off. I thought you were going to pass out.
Me too.
I stepped forward, extending a hand. Walt Longmire. Count Philip von Lehmann. He glanced past me. Thank you, Conrad. I'll take it from here. The young man came over.
You're sure?
Quite. Weston studied me for a bit longer and then entered the building as I turned back to the Count. I've heard a great deal about you.
Oh, no.
Most of it good. He waved with the cigarette in a vague loop. I can be an acquired taste. His face turned back to me. Sorry about that. Conrad's on loan and sometimes takes his responsibilities a little too seriously.
An interesting young man.
He nodded. Used to be quite an artist himself, until he discovered that arranging to sell paintings is actually more lucrative than simply painting. I watched as the young man observed us from inside. Barbara Schuster at the Brinton said you're gifted when it comes to ascertaining the credibility of period pieces of pigment encrusted canvas. He laughed to himself. This is an odd conversation to be having with a Wyoming sheriff. Come across something in a yard sale you want appraised?
You know what, Count?
I emphasize his title. You and I will probably get along a lot better when you stop underestimating me. He sat there for a moment, appraising me like one of those pigment-encrusted canvases. You might be onto something there. I have a tendency to perform, and I imagine it's quite annoying.
A bit.
He extended his hand this time. Philippe.
Walt.
I sat on the bench with him. What do you know about Cassily Adams? He stared at me for a moment, that he was lucky Anheuser-Busch brewed beer.
Anything else?
He thought about it.
Busch had F. Otto Becker rework the famous painting I'm assuming we're discussing, brightening the somber tones to prepare it for the lithograph, and there were about three different versions produced.
He inhaled the cigarette, raised his head, and exhaled. Which is why you see the damn thing in every bar, saloon, rumpus room, man cave, and garage in America. I nodded. I did a little research and discovered that Busch donated the actual painting to Custer's old outfit, the 7th Cavalry, in about 1895 when the unit was based in Fort Riley, Kansas. Later moved to Fort Grant in Arizona Territory, while the 7th was sent to Cuba in 1898 during the Spanish-American War. The painting languished, rolled up on a flagpole in the rafters of a forgotten building until Brigadier General Robert W. Strong discovered it on maneuvers in 1929 and contacted then-Commander Shelley, who took it back to Fort Bliss, where it was placed on display in the officers' club. He took a puff of his cigarette. God only knows what condition it was in at that point. Wasn't it sent to Boston during the Works Project Administration and repaired? It was, and then returned. It burned in 1946 along with the building in which it was housed. He studied me some more. If you don't mind me asking, why so much interest in a minor artist who painted a mediocre painting that was destroyed more than a half century ago? I think I may have an artist's study. A study?
Yep.
He smoked the last of the cigarette and then leaned down, crushing it out and depositing it into the pocket of the velvet duster that had seen better days.
May I see it?
I was hoping you'd ask.
He stood. When?
After the auction.
It's in the basement, in the conservation lab, being x-rayed. Supposedly they'll have some information for me, but I think it might be bad form to abandon the fundraiser.
He shrugged and pulled another cigarette from a pack of Dunhills he produced from another of the myriad pockets.
I am the epitome of bad form, but since I have a few paintings that I own that I donated for the auction, I think it would be de rigueur to wait until after.
Agreed.
He started toward the door, but then stopped. One last question.
Yep. Do you consider the gifts of a great artist to be a blessing or a curse?
It's according to the artist and the art.
He slowly smiled and gestured with the unlit cigarette. In the meantime, I have other performances to give, and if you find them tiresome, imagine how I feel about them. Break a leg.
Walking over and opening the glass door, he ventured in, where Conrad Weston waited.
One can only hope.
Where the hell have you been?
Talking with Count von Lehmann.
She reached up and fingered my collar. Should I check you for bite marks?
You'd only find yours.
She grinned and sipped her third martini. We appear to have lost the bear.
Probably got a better offer.
So how was the count? Any count at all?
An odd duck, as they say.
I thought about it. Kind of the absent-minded professor type, but there might be more than meets the eye. He any help with your painting?
We'll see. We're all going to take a look at it after the auction.
A private viewing, so to speak.
He watched the auction commence. There were a few items I was tempted to bid on, but I neglected to get a number and was subsequently left in the cold. The pangs of non-purchase weren't so bad until a familiar artist came up with a dramatic depiction of the Bighorn Mountain foothills.
Isn't that the artist you like from over in Bighorn?
Joel Oslin, yep.
She peered toward the stage where the price of the painting was rising. You like that one?
I like everything he does.
Her hand shot up with the card numbered 289. Back here, you assholes! The auctioneer made a face but then laughed before committing to the fray as Vic battled it out with a matriarch in the front row, a well-heeled couple to our left, and a short-haired blonde sitting with Conrad Weston about halfway back in the same row as Count von Lehmann. My undersheriff was standing pat at $4,000, and there was a momentary hesitation in the other buyers before the blonde struck again, setting off another round of bids that soon approached $8,000.
Isn't this getting a little rich for your blood?
Shut up! She raised her card again. What did I get you for Christmas?
That's not the point.
Your birthday.
I don't...
Shut up!
She raised the bid, and there was another pause, as the remaining buyers finally realized that bidding against Victoria Moretti was like swimming with sharks having been chummed to a state of frenzy. My father used to always say that when you bid on anything in an auction, be sure to set a price in your head as to what it's worth to you and not exceed it. Victoria Moretti had never heard that theory, and if she had, she'd discarded it long ago.
10,000!
The blonde in the middle row sat with her hands folded in her lap.
10,000 once, my undersheriff murmured under her breath. That's right, bitch. 10,000 twice.
The winning bidder scanned the ballroom with tarnished gold, daring anybody to take her on.
Sold. She turned to me. Give me your checkbook.
Sighing, I handed it to her. She disappeared, and I watched the remainder of the auction, enjoying the fact that the bidding was active and the museum would make a much-deserved profit. Still holding my jacket over my arm, I skirted the room and stopped at the nearest bar to get a beer.
Your friend, she must have wanted that painting badly.
Turning, I found the blonde from the bidding, the diminutive beauty with an undetermined accent, sipping what looked to be a vodka and tonic. I think it's a gift for me.
How very nice for you.
I extended a hand. Old Longmire.
Katrina Dijon?
We shook.
I know, I was on the outskirts of your dissertation on Van Gogh.
I bent my lips in a smile that I hoped conveyed a little humility.
Dissertation, huh? Hope it didn't seem that way. Oh, the Count was being pompous. And it was fun watching him taken down a notch.
You know him well?
Business partners. I've helped him with some acquisitions overseas.
You, Conrad, he must have an entire team here.
You met Conrad, too?
He seemed concerned for the Count's welfare.
She sighed. The Count has enemies.
I guess he's a shaker and mover, huh?
He has the ability to spot things before the public, which gives him an advantage in artistic trends.
She leaned in.
I don't mean to be nosy, but I noticed the two of you in conversation outside. What is that about?
An investigation concerning a piece of art. A study that may or may not be of significance.
Historic?
Possibly.
A sheriff concerned with a piece of artwork strikes me as fascinating. Can I see it?
I'm not so sure it'd be worth her time. I'm having it looked at now to determine the age.
Here? At the museum?
Yep. She smiled and shrugged.
Well, it must be of some worth if they're a part of your investigation.
Not really. They're just doing it as a favor.
She turned back and smiled up at me. One more question before I let you go. The really important one.
Sure.
Who is that friend of yours, the Native American?
Henry Standing Bear. He's Northern Cheyenne.
He's delectable, is what he is.
I nodded. You're not the first woman to notice.
I suppose not.
She glanced around some more, looking for the bear, no doubt.
Is he available?
I think you need to take that up with him. She eased away with a salacious smile.
I think I will.
I couldn't help but feel as if I'd just gotten the third degree, and then watched as she and Vic passed each other, both of them turning back for an appraising second look.
They don't give you your painting until the auction is over, but I paid for it.
She handed me my checkbook.
Well, you paid for it.
Thanks.
So, who's the chippy?
A patron of the arts, looking for access to the Cheyenne Nation.
Access? Is that what they're calling it these days?
Among other things. The bidding was continuing for the upper echelon, and I was just as glad that my depleted checkbook was back in my possession. Want to head down toward the conservation area in the basement and get the final ruling on the find of the century?
No, I have to get your painting soon, and I want to be at the head of the line.
I guess I'll go by myself then.
Deal.
I watched as she drifted toward the tables to the right of the stage, and then made my way along the wall back into the main lobby, only to be cut off by Donna Johnson.
A word, Walt?
More than one, if you'd like. She smiled, an asset that came in second to the computer-like mind of hers that had led her to the upper reaches of the Central Intelligence Agency, a portion of her life she rarely mentioned.
If you don't mind my asking, what's the story with you and Lehman?
I have a piece of art that I'm hoping to get appraised for a citizen, and from what I'm to understand, he's gifted in the field.
He is, she glanced around. He's also as slippery as a lubricated eel.
In what way?
She leaned in closer. He made his name filching unofficial art out of the Soviet Union back in the 90s. Millions of dollars worth of the stuff.
Kharitonov, Leis, Mikhno Voitenko, Nemyukhin, and Rukhins.
I shook my head. He doesn't strike me as the covert type.
Oh, he's not. That's just the problem. Back in the day, he got picked up by the KGB a half dozen times. So many times that we started thinking he must be working for them.
Was he?
I'm still not completely sure. But I do know he was approached by the agency and he turned them down, saying it might compromise his attempts to liberate the art and artists.
Liberate?
It was a period when art was severely controlled by the Russian government and anyone who was doing anything modern or abstract was perceived as perverse and an enemy of the state. The artists were harassed, their paintings burned, some even died under peculiar circumstances.
And Katrina Dijon?
An associate of his, French, I believe, but I don't think she was around during that period. She's more of a conduit to Russian oligarchs, who sometimes purchase art.
Illegal Russian art returning to the motherland?
Close to Newcastle, huh?
And Conrad Weston?
Who?
I glanced around, trying to catch a glimpse of the tall young man. He also appears to be attached to the Count.
Don't know him.
She looked around again.
Anyway, she's not the one to be careful of. Lehman has a bodyguard of sorts, Serge Bashirov, who is rumored to be ex-KGB.
You're kidding.
No. When the wall came down and Glasnost and the big thaw in the Cold War came, those guys were a dime a dozen. But don't underestimate him until I can do a little research.
What, he's got a poisoned umbrella?
She smiled up at me. I just want you to know the lay of the land, or steps, for that matter.
Got it.
She patted my arm as she turned and drifted back into the crowd. Be careful, big guy.
I watched her go and then moved along the wall, exiting through an archway and heading back into the main lobby. As I crossed toward the stairwell,
The hologram of Buffalo Bill suddenly appeared again, like a ghostly apparition.
"Ladies and gentlemen, permit me to introduce myself. I am William F. Cody. I'll show you some of the stirring scenes of the frontier."
I guess the thing was motion-activated, but it didn't make it any less unsettling, alone there in the darkened hall. Leaving Buffalo Bill to talk to himself, I walked down the hall and took the stairs leading below and then to the left. There were lights, but not much illumination, as I went down the wide hallway, past a number of displays, and through the double doors that led to the research library. The door at the far end of the boardroom was open, and I could see lights on in there. I figured that Beverly Nadine Perkins was probably still tied up upstairs, but that it wouldn't hurt anything for me to be there a little early. When I saw the door to the conservation area open, however, I got the feeling that something was wrong. Hurrying in, I could see someone lying on the floor, a lamp and scattered papers forming a kind of halo beside the large table where we'd studied the partial painting. Reaching for my trusty Colt at my side, I discovered that I'd neglected to include it in my formal attire. I kneeled by the table and could see that the conservator was still breathing, even with a pretty impressive bump at the back of her head. Rolling her to one side, I was relieved when she raised her hand to brush away my assistance. "Beverly, are you okay?"
"What the heck?
I think you must have fallen." She reached to the back of her head.
"I guess. I was just coming down here to meet you, and I must have fainted or something."
Propping her up, I looked to the side and saw a small Chinese statue of one of the terracotta soldiers of the Qin Shi Huang dynasty lying on the floor, broken. I held it up to her.
"Did you knock this off the table when you fell?"
She looked at it, continuing to massage the back of her head.
"No, that's from Margaret's desk in the next room."
Examining the thing, I could see a little blood and hair attached to the edge of one shoulder of the figurine.
"Somebody hit you with this."
Mary Robinson appeared in the doorway behind us.
"I'm sorry, but am I interrupting something?"
I slowly pulled Beverly up to a standing position. "I think your co-worker has been attacked." She came over and took the conservator's hand.
"Are you all right?"
Beverly nodded carefully.
"I think so. But why would anybody?"
Her eyes darted toward the table.
"It's gone."
"The Adam study?"
"Yes."
"How long have you been down here?" Peering at her wristwatch, she glanced back up at me.
"Less than 10 minutes, I'd say."
I handed her to Mary. "Call 911 and get an ambulance to check her out. I came down the main entrance before you did, so I doubt anybody could have gotten through the way we came in." Looking around the room, I spotted the only other doorway. "Where does that go?" Mary assisted Beverly to a chair. "It's a utility hallway. There's locked storage space and access to the auditorium and pretty much every room on this level that way." "Great." Stepping toward it, I turned back. "Stay here, but call security and have them send some people down to cover the exits."
"Where are you going?"
"I'm going to go look for that painting." Pushing the heavy fire door open, I stepped into the hallway, lined with bays covered with security wire. The lights were on when I entered, evidently set off by motion, and I watched as they reflected along the concrete floor. Feeling rather naked without my sidearm, I advanced, checking the bays as I went, but discovering they were all locked. Continuing on, I reached a crossroads with hallways going in opposite directions, but then noticed the lights were only on in the one straight ahead. Testing my theory, I stepped in the one to the right and waited as it flickered on. Looking back at the one straight ahead, I returned to that course. Reaching down, I opened the first door and found another storage area, this one for office supplies, which caused the lights to flicker on as I had supposed. Closing that door, I advanced and checked the next to my right, the lights not being on inside. I turned the knob, but it was locked, so I went on to the next to find a utility room full of breaker boxes and custodial supplies, my motion turning on the lights once again. Moving to the next door, which was quite a bit farther, I discovered an entryway that met another, but in this one, the lights were on. Pushing the door open the rest of the way and checking to make sure it wouldn't lock behind me, I entered what turned out to be an anteroom and then pushed open the next door to find myself in the back of an auditorium, the steps to a light booth to my immediate right. No automatic lights came on, and I surmised that the much larger room must have been on a separate system,
the only illumination in the theater being warning lights at the foot of the rounded stage and small ones in the seat stanchions along the two carpeted aisles. As the door quietly closed behind me, I waited and listened. There was no sound, and I glanced around, seeing a set of doors to my left that must have been the main entrance, and then another door to the far right marked as a fire exit. I slowly began making my way down the aisle, checking the rows on both sides as I went. Getting to the front of the house and then center stage, I looked back at all the empty seats and the closed curtain behind me. I found the opening in the curtain and pulled it aside to glance around. Finding a podium and an upright piano but nothing else, I dropped the curtain and was about to give up when I heard something. It was the scuff of shoe leather on concrete, unless I missed my guess. Glancing down, I was pretty sure the entire auditorium was carpeted. The anteroom was concrete, but that was on the other side of the heavy door, leaving the steps to the light booth as the only place from which the noise could have emanated. Quietly moving back to my right, I got as far as the steps when there was a commotion at the doorway where I'd entered, a slab of light casting across the carpet. Jumping from the low stage, I ran up the aisle toward the door and blew through it and the next, ending up in the empty hallway as footsteps slapped in a rapid retreat. I ran toward the noise and found myself in the crossroads. I turned right where the lights had come on and ran forward and spotted a figure dart around a corner at the far end. Charging down the hallway as fast as I could,